Attack of the Final Girls is a podcast about the horror genre, so listener discretion is advised. Please check the show notes for specific content warnings for this episode, and of course, beware of spoilers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Attack of the Final Girls. I'm Teresa.
And I'm Juliet.
And we're here once again on our bi-weekly, every 2 weeks, whatever you call that. And bi-weekly is such an amorphous word. I never know which one is the right thing to say.
I always feel like I have to clarify. I'm like, bi-weekly. By that, I mean every 2 weeks.
Can we, like, all together as, like, English language, like, come up with a better way to say that?
Yeah.
Like, flammable and inflammable. They mean the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
Let's just like strike one word from the lexicon. I don't care which, just
yeah.
One of them.
Yeah.
And then same with bi-weekly and semi-weekly. What?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, whatever you want to call it, we are here to tell you about an 80s movie. You've probably never seen it.
Yeah, probably not.
If you have, you're a member of a very small amount of people that have seen this movie. It just got re-released by Terrorvision.
Yes. And it's available on Screambox now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's yeah. Right. I think it's on Tubi, too.
Oh, okay.
Tubi, just skirting in with, like, all the weird horror stuff that you could ever want or need.
Tubi's out there doing the work. Like, they are the heroes we need, but truly. Not necessarily the heroes we deserve.
And this one probably isn't going to, like, make it to any, like, of the featured items at the top of the screen or whatever, because they're too busy shilling the Tubi original stuff.
Yeah.
So this movie, we're featuring Door today from 1988, a Japanese horror film. It is subtitled.
Yes.
And I think Terrorvision put it out on Blu-ray.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Otherwise, I probably would have never heard of this movie before. It's not something that gets a lot of like love. It's not even really like a cult film even.
Yeah. Part of that is because it never got a U.S. theatrical release. It never really made it over to the U.S. in any way, shape, or form. It has become kind of a lost movie in terms of international audiences. Obviously, it's well known in Japan. You can kind of see if you look up this movie, there was a flurry of articles in late 2023 as this movie was getting ready to release on Screambox and Terrorvision had announced their physical media release of it, because everyone was agreeing that this is a movie that needs more love. Like, this is a very important Japanese horror movie, but it's one that admittedly a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, I had never heard of it before. Once again, I'm going to, you know, shit on IMDb a little bit. There is very little about the actors and actresses that are featured within this film on IMDb. I'm assuming that there is a lot of stuff missing in terms of Southeast Asian movies in general from IMDb, which is unfortunate for me because I would love to use that as like a one-stop shop to find more movies by this particular director. But yeah, there's just not a lot of data out there about it. There's no trivia on IMDb about it either.
No.
It is a very interesting and very straightforward movie. I think it certainly inspired a lot of films, whether that be directly or sort of just in the culture. Movies like Red Eye with Cillian Murphy or Panic Room. It definitely seems like this movie sort of, even if not directly, spiritually inspired those movies and other movies like it. I really enjoyed it. This was the first time for both of us to watch this one. I didn't know what to expect. And I did get to watch the trailer. So like immediately before we watched it, Juliet had seen the trailer. I watched the trailer right before we watched the movie. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, this is pretty good. And it's been referred to as a giallo film. And so I thought, okay, that means it's going to be weird.
Yep.
Because when we think of like Italian giallo movies, we're like, okay, there's going to be like some sort of weirdness happening, like some sort of weird supernatural thing, gloves, close-up shots of knives. And some of those things happen, but it's a lot more straightforward, I think, than many Italian giallo films.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. People call this Japan's first giallo. Also, some people refer to it as Japan's first home invasion film. You know, that's subjective, obviously, you know, whether you want to give it that title or not. I will say, like, it is a very strong example of both of those genres, of obviously a Japanese cinematic interpretation of both of those genres. But you see the hallmarks of both of those subgenres in this film in really interesting ways. And I think that it should have a place in both the history of giallo going international beyond Italy, as well as home invasion films. Like, this to me is such a strong example of like a good home invasion film that, as you said, whether it directly influenced the modern stuff that we know, is definitely a spiritual predecessor to a lot of modern American home invasion films.
So the premise is there is a woman and her family, the Honda family, I'll just say for right now, they live in this apartment complex. The dad is a worker bee. He's like pretty much all the time out of the apartment. And there is a sort of pushy salesman who tries to deliver this sales information to the mom, and she smashes his hand in the door, and he turns into this like stalker, dangerous bad guy, and chaos ensues. It's wild how quickly things kind of go from zero to 180 in this movie. We also have a very small cast of characters. It's basically the Honda family. Keiko Takahashi plays Yasuko Honda. She's the mom, the matriarch. You have Shiro Shimamoto, who plays Satoru Honda, her husband, who is in the movie for like all of 5 minutes. Only enough for you to know that he's missing. Like that he's not in the picture. He's at work or on this work trip, so he won't be home. There's Takuto Honda, played by Takuto Yonezu, her son, sort of a dangling, dangerous, you know, extra complication in the story. And then there's the bad guy, Yamakawa, who is played by Daijiro Susumi. He is our antagonist. He's our bad guy here. And that's it. That's like all that you need to know. And there's four main characters. And even one of those is like a minor character. I think if the dad had not even been in this movie, it would have played out pretty much the same.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, if he had just been gone on a work trip the entire time, like, I feel like we wouldn't have lost too much. I'm glad that he was in it, and I don't think that the director, like, made a bad choice with that. I'm just saying, like, that's how involved this guy is.
Yeah, I think it was important for us to understand that when he's home, he is, like, a good, loving, caring spouse and parent, that Yasuko is not in a position of, yes, she's isolated in the way that women whose lives and careers are at home with their children, you know, running the household, but she is not yearning for, you know, someone else. Her husband isn't cruel to her. He's not having an affair, which I commented in the movie. I feel like if this was an American film, his absences, we would have gotten some kind of like cut to like coworkers making an excuse for him and a cutaway to him having an affair. That is not the case. He's just working all the damn time. And when you look at Japanese men of this particular generation, especially in the 80s when this film is set, that's very common. You know, he's a very ordinary man in that regard. You know, this is not an unusual circumstance that this family finds themselves in. And I think that's important to the danger, the element of danger in the story.
Yeah, and I do want to say really quick before we keep going that the director, Banmei Takahashi, is actually Keiko Takahashi, the woman who plays Yasuko, that they're married. By the time this movie came out, they had been married for 6 years. So interesting husband and wife duo. I know that that's not, you know, like Rachel Weisz and Darren Aronofsky were married for a long time. She was in Fountain for him. And so it's not uncommon, but it is uncommon for everything to like work out well and not like implode, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So, but yeah, the dynamic of the family is like very, very drab and ordinary. There's not much that's surprising. The only thing I think that stands out is that it seems like they have recently moved into this apartment.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is because very early on in the movie, Yasuko goes to take the trash out and it's the wrong day. So somebody else from the apartment actually takes the trash back to her house and puts it in front of her door. And she's like, oh man, I messed up. Like, I guess it's not that day. And there is a sign that says, like, only dump your trash on Mondays and Wednesdays. We don't know what day it is, but apparently it's not Monday or Wednesday. So we've already started off. There's already that layer of, you know, isolation of the family because they just don't know anybody yet. They don't know their neighbors. They don't know when to take the trash out. There is that little bit of newness to their situation there in the apartment building, which I found interesting because very quickly you see that neighbors and other people in this building are not willing or able to intervene in strange or maybe ominous situations.
Yeah, I kind of loved that. Having lived in a high-rise apartment building for many, many years, the sort of duality of that experience that you are in very close quarters with people, but there's often this tension of like, you have a lot of shared space with others. You have shared hallways where you can kind of hear everyone that's coming and going. And this line of like, do I hop up and see what's going on at every noise? Do I just respect that this is the environment that I'm in? Am I the nosy neighbor? Am I the busybody? Do I let others be to their own devices? It's a tension and it's a balancing act. And I found that very relatable, you know, that sort of like, you know, what's that noise in the hall? Is it worth investigating? Is it just that we're in close proximity to other humans? Is there something weird going on? How much do I need to have my guard up in my own home at all times? I liked the setting a lot for that.
Yeah, like really early on in this movie, Yasuko's being basically hounded by, you know, telemarketers, people who are coming door to door and trying to like get her to take this information. And she's tired of it. I mean, if you live in America, like there's the whole joke about like your car's extended warranty expiring because you're going to get like 50 million postcards and phone calls and stuff like that. The same with like insurance. If anybody in your family has Medicare or Medicaid, like Lord have mercy, you're going to have 1,000 phone calls about that.
Oh, the new one is now natural gas suppliers. If I get one more phone call asking me about changing my natural gas supplier, I'm like, I don't know. This is what I pay a company for. I don't care.
Just take my money.
Like, yeah.
There are very few things in the world that I feel like I have the capacity to like make that a thing that I'm going to be worried about.
Right.
And my natural gas supplier is not one of them.
Yeah.
Like they come to your door and they're like, you will save lots of money if you change your natural gas supplier. I'm like, look, I'm sorry. I understand that this is important to you and this is your job, but I literally could not care less.
Yeah.
About my natural gas supplier.
Yeah.
Like, is my gas working? Thumbs up.
Yeah. Am I breathing in toxic chemicals right now? No. Okay. We're good. We're fine.
No changes, please. Like, yeah. I will pay an extra $25 a month for you to just not come over here anymore.
Yeah.
And I know that that's like an American apathetic thing. And like, I probably should care about it. But also, there are some people that make that in their entire lives, like couponing, the ability to find ways to save money and things like that. I cannot do that. That is not a thing that I have space in my life to be able to micromanage.
Same.
Like, there's just not enough hours in the day to do that. Maybe when I'm retired, we can revisit this discussion and I'll be like, no, I definitely care about that. But like, no.
I was having a conversation literally yesterday with a couple of colleagues over lunch about grocery shopping and this exact thing. And I was like, look, I live 5 minutes from a grocery store. That's the grocery store I'm going to. I don't care that it's the air quotes expensive grocery store, even though it's actually not as expensive, as exorbitantly expensive as all the others. They're all expensive now. Food costs money.
Yeah.
But I resent this sort of like guilt, especially toward femme people, like femme people who are in charge of a household, that in addition to all of the other bullshit that you have to do, you know, and your job, you need to be like thrifty and like it's somehow a failure of being like a femme person if you're not like couponing and thrifting and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I do not have the bandwidth for that. Like, and I just, you know, whoops, it's a moral failure, whatever. And unless, I'm like, I don't care.
Unless somebody puts a coupon in my hand as I'm purchasing a thing, I literally could not care less.
Yeah.
Because like for every 50 cents I'm saving on this item, that's 50 cents that I'm spending somewhere else dumb.
Yeah.
So you are able to do the grocery shopping thing where you go frequently throughout the week.
I do.
I cannot. The only way I can do grocery shopping is I have to set aside 30 minutes on a Tuesday for me to sit at my computer and go onto the Kroger website and make all of my selections for the week. And then I drive there and they load it into the back of my car. Because if I go into the grocery store every time, my mental well-being goes down. It is an intersecting graph of how often and how long I have to spend in the grocery store versus how unhappy I am about it. And I also spend way too much money because I'll be like, I just need to go in for X, Y, and Z for dinner tonight. And then I'm like, well, I'm buying those cookies and those chips. And oh, I forgot. I should probably get something to snack on too. And then $40 later, I'm like, shit.
And see, I have the opposite problem. These are just two ends of like a neurospicy spectrum here. Because if I try to go and do like one big grocery trip, I get very overwhelmed because I'm like, but what if I don't get anything? And then I still have to go back. And I'm like, I would rather just on my way home from work, I'm like, here's what we're having for dinner. I will buy the things and oh, we'll have leftovers for tomorrow. Great, whatever. Yeah, one trip, I get just like anxious and I can't do it.
Where you're like, I need two carts worth of groceries.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
So that I don't forget anything.
Yeah, I actually buy more shit I don't need if I do one big trip. As opposed to like going like after work, like every couple of days. Cause when I do like one big trip, I'm just like, oh yeah, of course I'm gonna get this bulk rice that we're gonna eat a ton. Like, and then we never do.
You're like, I bought 20 pounds of rice and it's literally lasted 5 years.
Yeah.
And I should correct myself.
I have done shit like that.
I should correct myself too. I should have said like the Great Depression mindset.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
like
you're absolutely right.
You, like I need to buy everything so that I don't forget one thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Like a culture of scarcity shopping.
Exactly. Yeah. Like scarcity shopping.
Yeah. Yeah.
As where I am like, I must spend less than $100 on my weekly shopping trip. I'm also much less likely to impulse buy stuff if I'm online because I'm like, I'm not searching for like cookies.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As where if I go into the grocery store, I'm like, cookies, you know? Yeah. Anyways, Yasuko doesn't do any grocery shopping. We digress. I think she picks up something.
We like, see her cooking a lot.
Yeah, she does cook a lot. She does have like that grocery bag of stuff, but like, Who knows? I don't know what's inside of that. It could be anything. It's just a brown paper bag. But yeah, she's the matriarch. She is in charge of keeping their home together. She's in charge of taking care of their son, who is active and a cute little boy. So he's like doing boy shit, like sports and roller skating and all kinds of stuff. And she's also trying to keep everything together while her husband is away. So he mentions that he has a work colleague who's going to be gone. So he has to be at this place where his work colleague is. So he's going to be gone for 3 days. And then later that gets extended a little bit. So that's kind of our like element of danger there.
Yeah.
Is that Yasuko and her son are going to be there by themselves, which is not a strange, random thing. It does put a little bit of extra strain on her because obviously like she's having to take him to school, cook dinner, bring him home. She's all by herself. She's having to like fend off these pesky salespeople and telemarketers and shit all by herself. But it's not uncommon. Like,
yeah.
She's like, I got this down. We got a routine. No big deal. I'll do it. But like, don't make this like forever thing because I don't want it to be like that. And she doesn't even really gripe about it that much. She's just like, oh, okay, like disappointed. Also, I think sort of disappointed because she's not going to be able to see her husband for a couple of days.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And her kid's not going to have his dad for a couple of days.
Right.
And as I said before, they seem like a very loving, functional family. And although he does work all the time, we do see, and I think this is an important note, we do see the dad taking the kid to school one day. You know, so the dad is, although he is working all the time, he is helping out in little ways. So it's not all on her, but obviously it is when he's away.
And the family dynamic definitely seems like she's there to support that. Like,
yeah.
She's aware of how things go. He's a man who does computer things. Shruggy shoulders,
yeah.
Like we see like some lines of code running on a computer and we're like, Yep,
I was
that's
like,
what he does.
The Matrix? Neo?
He definitely is an original architect for The Matrix. No, I'm just kidding. He's like doing computer stuff. And when she tries to call him, that's the other thing, is that she's very cognizant of his work environment and the fact that he's probably very busy. And so when she tries to call him because like stuff's starting to go weird, they're like, he's busy in the machine room. Like, are you sure? And that's all they say. And she's like, oh, in that case, okay. Like, never mind. Don't bother him. So it definitely seems like she's understanding of the circumstance and that she's there to support it in a very like normal Japanese late 80s way.
Yeah.
There's not anything strange going on. He's not having an affair, which we definitely see thrown into a lot of like family movies. He's not doing any weird stuff. Like, he's just very normal. And that is what makes the surrounding circumstances of when things start to go wild all that much more sinister, because this is a very typical situation. You have a, at this point, single, although she's not divorced, she is married, single as in she's only by herself and at home with her son in this apartment complex. She's doing all of her normal, regular things. And then this kind of sinister, you know, Yamakawa guy comes and does something very normal. He's like, I'm going to try and sell you this thing. And she's like, I'm so sick of this. Like, please shut up. He's like, no, I'm going to put this paper into your door, opening the door against the chain, which, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, no. If anybody even like knocked on my door and then tried my door handle, I'd be like, oh, hell no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I and maybe that's an American thing, because like, I don't know what the situation is like in Japan. Is it a situation where everybody just leaves their doors unlocked? And she's like being, because her husband even chides her, like, aren't you being overly paranoid about locking the door? So I don't know if they just like leave their doors unlocked at this point in time. But here, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
0% chance.
Well, and you can tell that like the whole him trying the door thing is not normal, you know, based on her reaction to that door handle, that those constant tension building shots of the door handle moving that are just like the most subtle movement, but are beautiful because you're just like, no, right? Yikes.
Like, you know that the chain is on the door, but that doesn't make that motion like less gross.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's so, so gross. And then his response to her was such a moment to me. So there's this thing that I think all femme folks have experienced, which is that when a man does something that we have been taught over and over and over again coming up could lead to violence, we respond in fear and we're cautious. And then the man's reaction is to get offended at our fear and respond with more violence. And that's exactly what we see play out in that first interaction between the door, is he is coming at her in a way that is very forceful and is inappropriate for the interaction. And she's scared. Of course you would be scared. And he takes her fear as an affront. And his solution to that, to his affront, is do more violence toward her. And it was just such a, that scene was such a perfect distillation of things I see play out in real life so many times, over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's a very classic situation. Man does something that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
Woman responds in fear, in anger, you know, as a response to whatever this is. Man immediately either tries to make the woman feel bad about it or responds with more anger.
And then she apologizes.
Yes.
Which is kind of a subtle thing after this sort of violent, scary interaction. And he leaves. She's sitting there kind of shaken. And she says, sorry.
Yeah.
And it's like, ugh.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and, you know, he like tries to plead to her to say like, well, I'm not going to be able to work because you smashed my hand. Don't you think that you could give me a few minutes of your time? And she's like, and she pushes back. She says, you don't need your hand to do what you do, which is be an annoying salesperson. All you need is your voice. And that's when he the switch flips in him. He leaves for a while and then he comes back and kicks the door for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
He kicks the door for so long. I wrote that down. I'm like, if somebody was at my next door neighbor's house kicking in their door for 5 minutes, you bet your ass I would not just be like sitting there. Her neighbors don't come. The only neighbor that she has, there's in the credits, is an old man with the eye patch who like peers out of his door and does nothing. There's nobody else, though, that comes to her rescue. This dude is loudly kicking her metal apartment door for a long time, and nobody comes to save her.
Yeah.
Nobody, there's nobody else there that is her support system in this building.
Yeah.
It's wild. And this dude gets away with doing this, gets away with perpetrating this act of violence for a long time. And there's a point, because although we get to see him kicking, there's a point where we're focused on Yasuko's face, and she, like, you can see her resolve harden against this character. Like, I am not going to let this guy do this to me.
Yeah.
And we see her escalating fear, but we also see her escalating resolve as the movie goes on. And I thought that was a really interesting scene to just see her, like, the fear kind of drain out of her face. And she's like, this is just a thing that's happening.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to let this happen.
Yeah. We see those moments over and over again. Similarly, a kind of notable thing in the shooting of this film, before we get to like the big, big notable thing, is I loved that so often when Yasuko is talking to somebody else, like another man who is in an official capacity, a capacity to potentially help her, it is always shot over the shoulder of that man. So we never see his face, and we're always focused on her face, on her experience. And it's typically her experience of sort of being told, like, well, there's not enough here to really do anything about it. Again, so relatable. Like, this movie was made in Japan in 1988. So relatable to my experience as an American woman in 2024. Like, so relatable. But I love the choice of the director to not make it like a two shot where they're sitting across the table from each other, but to keep it focused, that we as an audience are focused on her face, on her reaction. And we're almost put in the role of that other person, of that witness having to make that choice. Like, do I do something? Do I not do something?
Yeah. And I mean, once again, in this movie, we see police who are like, oh, that's weird. Yeah. Just let us know if something else happens.
Yeah.
You know? And I also love, at the same token, when we have these like male, you know, figures of authority, their voices are always weird. I don't know if that was a specific choice on the part of the director. I'm hoping so, because their voices sound like they've come through like a tin can.
Yeah.
They kind of like Charlie Browned it, you know, where like the adults in Charlie Brown are like, wah, wah, wah. They're not exactly like that in this movie, but the guy who comes to deliver a package to Yasuko, she's so freaked out because he like pounds on the door, and she's so freaked out, and he's like, I have a package for you.
Yeah.
It sounds like he's talking through a mask. And the police officer is similar, where when he's talking to her, he kind of has like this weird mask on his voice. And the only person, the only two people who don't are Yamakawa and her husband. They're the only two men in this movie that don't have that like strange affectation. So I don't know if that was a specific choice on the part of the director, but I think it works.
Oh, yeah. And if it wasn't a specific choice, it's a happy accident that enhances the film. You know, sometimes we have that in older movies or just in movies that are, you know, made on different levels in different spaces, where something about the technique that was a matter of just resources or what was available or whatever becomes something that actually serves the story in a really, really cool way. And we don't know which it was in this case, but either way, it works.
Yeah. I also think that the insidious way that Yasuko is sort of, I mentioned before, they're sort of like alienated a little bit from the people. The insidious way that like tiny pieces of her agency are like removed is so fascinating to me. When they bring the trash back up and she's like, oh, I messed that up. It's just like wild to me. All of this is so fascinating. Her husband sort of like undermining her idea of like, you know, locking the door and going to the police, and just like these little tiny things where people are like, you're being weird. And then also the ways that she tries to clean up after herself so that she does not appear to be weird.
Yeah.
Like after Yamakawa originally comes to her door and kicks it down, he writes something really foul on the door. And everybody's like looking at her door like, what the hell? Because it says something like, I'm really sexually repressed. Will you please come in and do me?
Yeah.
So she like goes outside to clean it up because she's like, first of all, she doesn't want to bring attention to herself because she's new in this building. And also it's just foul. Like she doesn't want that to be what her neighbors think of her because they already think that she's terrible. Number one, because of the trash thing. Number two, she finds... Yamakawa puts in her mailbox a tissue that has his semen in it. And she like freaks out and throws it. It's like, ugh, you know, gross, because like who wouldn't? That's disgusting. But a neighbor sees her do that. And so that's like one more step of her being like, because in Japan, you do not throw trash on the ground. It is considered very, 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 very terrible taste to throw trash on the ground. It is a very, very clean area. And for her to just throw it on the ground, there's a woman, we don't ever see who she is, but she's walking up the steps and she sees her do that. And she's like, obviously, she stops.
Yeah.
To the point where Yasuko is so like, oh God, I shouldn't have done that. She picks it up and takes it with her.
Yeah.
To her apartment to flush. And I'm just like, oh, I'm so sorry that you have to feel like you minimize yourself, you know, in this situation. It's wild. Those just those little tiny things that make her separate.
Even with her son, when she picks him up from school, and again, like she's there, she's trying to be very safe. She's trying to get him home, and he throws a tantrum.
Right.
And obviously, this is a child, but even then, you see some of her agency being chipped away because she is aware of this situation that's feeling very threatening. It's closing in on her and she's trying to keep herself and her kid safe. And her kid is just like freaking out, wilding out, as children do. But then instead of worrying about the primary concern, which is safety, now she's got to try to get her kid settled, get him some juice, try to get him in a good place. And it's just, oh, you really feel for her throughout this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, she clearly can handle herself in these situations, but these like underlying pressures of living in this apartment building and living in Japan and her husband not being there to help support her at this moment, like it just piling up. It makes it so easy for Yamakawa to kind of insert himself into her life in this like nefarious purpose. He's able to find out so much about her so easily.
Yeah.
Because he already knows where she lives. Like, that's one piece of very protected information, especially for femme people, is your address.
Yeah.
Like, the physical location where you live. It's scary to have to give that out to someone and for someone to know where your personal space is. So although we see Yasuko outside of her apartment in certain scenes, that's, like, our main focus is her apartment and the intrusion into her space, into her sanctuary. Like, he's able to find out so much about her outside of, you know, he knows where she lives. He's looking through her mail. Like, he knows what car her husband drives because he can see him come to her, you know, and he knows that he's not home. He knows where her son goes to school. He knows all of the places that she goes. And the dangerous aspect of this is that until late in the movie, Yasuko doesn't know what Yamakawa looks like.
Right.
She has no idea. They're crossing spaces all the time, and she does not know that. We know that as viewers, but she doesn't know that she's in danger and how close the danger is on a regular basis. I find that fascinating.
Oh, yeah. You know, this movie reminds me a lot of the movie Watcher, not the Netflix thing, but the movie from 2022 that was, I think it was on my top 10 of 2022. With Micah Monroe in it.
Yeah.
That same thing of like this edging danger, this encroaching into somebody's space. And then those on the outside of her direct situation are kind of like, is it? And it's just like, this person knows so much about you in ways that are just so threatening. I thought a lot about that movie as we were watching this.
Yeah, it's very similar. That one was set in Budapest or like Prague or something.
I think Budapest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a good parallel. It's very similar where you have like this dude that is doing bad things and people are like, it's not that bad though.
Yeah.
Is it really that bad?
Yeah. And you have a person who is in a newer environment, sort of already feeling a little maybe displaced or unmoored. The person that they're there with is away a lot. Yeah, there are some similarities. Obviously, that one veers off in a bit of a different direction. But I think the general premise and the general like setup and lead up to the sort of big confrontation, they're very parallel.
I like that one a lot, too.
Me too.
We should rewatch that one now that it's been a little while.
Yeah, we should. Put that on the list.
For sure. Let's talk about this movie in terms of it being a giallo film. I know we chatted about it a little bit earlier on, but some of the really specific things that I think lend this movie into being sort of a Japanese giallo film is that we have a voiceover happening. We have basically dubbing that's happening. And it's very good. It's very good dubbing.
Yeah.
It's very solid. It is, since it's a Japanese language film and we have the benefit of having subtitles, like there's a little bit less, I think. I always feel a little bit disconnected from an Italian giallo film because of those pieces of dubbing. Mm-hmm. And often Italian directors will make the choice to have an American voice actor redub over the Italian actor or the original actor's lines. And sometimes that can take you out of it a step. And I think it's on purpose. I think that it's meant to put you a little off. And you'll notice that. I mean, it's very obvious in certain movies where you're like, okay, yeah, this is obviously dubbed. Like, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
In this movie, the dubbing is done very, very well. But the combination of the dubbing and the sound cues in this movie really make it feel like an Italian film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Those recurring themes that we hear over and over again that help kind of clue us into the main character's state of mind or what is happening or what is about to happen. That is very much a hallmark of giallo.
Yeah. The music sometimes is not representative of the vibe that the scene is giving off, you know, like some of the scenes where the main theme of this movie kind of sounds like an 80s action film, like think Miami Vice type, you know, soundtrack. And sometimes like we have a really dangerous situation that's happening and we have this music superimposed over the scene. You're like, this is weird. Like, this is a strange vibe. You know, like this isn't necessarily a sinister or like threatening song, but we're playing it over a sinister and or threatening scene.
Yeah.
Some of the sound cues are like that, too. Like the scene where Yasuko is talking to the police officer, there's like this chime noise from a train over and over again.
Yeah.
It was a strange sound cue, but interesting, especially because that was coming right off of another kind of threatening scene where we had that like strange sort of like upbeat 80s theme song. So
yeah, I loved that thing with the train and the chime because to me, it just reinforced the fact that Yasuko was not being heard.
Yeah.
You know, like not only was the police officer, you know, not taking her situation with the gravity that it deserved, but literally there were sounds that were, you know, so loud that they were overpowering her.
Yeah. In other instances, there is a lack of sound design, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
There's a scene when Yamakawa finally gets into the apartment after Yasuko thinks that her son has like gone missing and she's aware that this dude is like near her and watching her. She thinks that this is after he throws the tantrum. She's like, oh shit, you know, where's my kid? Well, it ends up that her son escaped and left to go to his friend's house, which she told him he was not allowed to go to because of this whole extenuating circumstance. When Yamakawa finally gets into the apartment, there is no sound except for her breathing and Yamakawa taking steps as he's leading her with a knife further into her apartment. And I'm like, man, this is so good.
Yeah.
It's so giallo. It's so Italian. The fact that there are times when we're allowed to hear only what's happening. There's no additional sounds, additional noises, weird, you know, songs, which sometimes that adds to it. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
And in this case, we're just allowed to hear, you know, what's occurring between the two of them only.
Yeah. Other giallo elements, there's some use of red, which I feel like is a little subtle hat tip there. And also just some of those like really, really close-up shots of weapons, specifically knives, but also other like blades and cooking implements in this film specifically. There are a couple of shots that feel like intentional hat tips to that genre.
Yeah, shiny silver stuff.
Yep.
Jalo movies love to show a light glint off of a knife or whatever. Yeah. That happens a couple of times in this movie. We've been talking about how Yasuko's life is like compartmentalized and like kind of claustrophobic. They make the apartment, because we determined as we're watching this that the apartment has to be a set, but the outside of the apartment is probably a real building.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't build a whole ass apartment building for this, but the inside of it, the interior is definitely a set, and it is compartmentalized to make you feel even more claustrophobic.
Yes.
It's not an open plan. I don't know if this is specific. Maybe it's something where, like, you know, in the 80s, it was like cool to have more rooms. And now in Japanese apartments, it's like more in style to have more open concepts. Uh-huh. But this house is very closed down. There are lots of doors. I mean, outside of just even the front door, there are doors from the front entryway into the living room. There's a door from the kitchen slash dining area into a hallway. There's a door there from the hallway into the master bedroom. There's a door from there into the child's bedroom. There are two doors in terms of the bathroom. Like, there's doors all over the place. And in traditional Japanese architecture, and I know that this is supposed to be set in a more modern apartment, but rather than having 1,000 doors, you actually have sliding doors where you could compartmentalize an area if you wanted, or leave it more open if you wanted to. So it's very different than what we're kind of conditioned to see in Japanese houses. And also, it makes you feel very closed in. All of the spaces are very tight. This isn't like a mansion, you know, where, yeah, you might have 30 doors, but you also have like huge rooms. This is not like that. It is a very small apartment.
I've seen a lot online where folks have taken sets from various television shows. I know I've seen it for Seinfeld and Golden Girls and Friends very specifically, where people try to draw out what the actual floor plan of these apartments are, and it makes like no sense in the real world. And I feel like this apartment is intentionally designed that way, to like intentionally designed as a set that's like kind of mishmashed together to throw you off and to get that labyrinthian feel. Because the thing that stuck out about this film that made me want to cover this based on the trailer is they do overhead shots, which you so rarely see in horror, like really almost breaking the fourth wall and saying like, no, this is a set. We're going to see two people on either side of a door from above to sort of really delineate that line between them, that thin barrier. They don't overuse it, which I really appreciate. It would be really, really easy to just like grind that metaphor to death. But they use it in the beginning, in that early confrontation. And then they use it at the very end during sort of like the big, big chase. We have this chase throughout the apartment where we really start to understand that there are these many, many doors and compartments and rooms. And it felt like a labyrinth to me, seeing it from above. Like, it felt like anytime you see like the chase and the Shining and the hedge maze, mm-hmm. like to both instill the danger for the character that they're trying to wind through, you know, this place that is set up a little, you know, oddly, but also to really, as a viewer, like disorient you and make you feel as kind of frustrated and fraught and in danger as the main character because of this weird floor plan, that it's not a straight ahead line, like just keep running straight. You're dodging things, you're going through doors, and the whole time the killer is pursuing you.
Yeah, there was a lot of fun moments where you're like, oh, she's safe. And then like, oh, no, he popped out of this random area. Like, just watch out for that, because it's so much fun and like really builds this sense of mania towards the end of the movie. There's, because like she's throwing stuff at this guy, she's trying to smash him into stuff, she's trying to shut doors, and he's just busting through these doors, and we feel claustrophobic because we're like, man, this apartment's like 500 square feet, what the hell.
Yeah.
And also like, you need to get out of here, like try not to put yourself into a corner, which she ends up doing. And that really ratchets things up too, is that when we're following her being chased by Yamakawa through the apartment, you know, she's like shutting doors and he's coming through them, but there's always an extra door for her to go out. Well, then she gets to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere else to go. There's no windows in this bathroom. There's only one door, and Yamakawa's standing on the other side of this door. And we get like a Here's Johnny moment, even, you know, with this tiny electric chainsaw.
It's quite wee.
and we see it earlier in the movie, and she's like, oh, my husband and his hobbies or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know who is doing woodworking on the patio of their high-rise apartment.
But good on you.
Yeah, like, cool for you for having hobbies, but what a weird one to have. And also, I think I'd be pissed as a neighbor if this dude's just, like, out there going at it with a friggin' electric chainsaw. I'd be like, this is not safe.
Yeah.
Please refrain from doing this, sir. The implements in this movie of danger, like, you have a knife, which is very, that's, like, a classic thing. Like, Yamakawa was threatening Yasuko with this knife. And, you know, that's very classic. But the other implements of, like, defense and attack in this movie are so weird. Grill fork.
Yep.
A pair of child's roller skates.
Yeah, like the 80s ones that strapped onto your shoes. I definitely had a pair in, like, 1985.
And then an umbrella.
Yeah.
Which the umbrella, like, you know, meets its end pretty soon because, like, umbrella versus chainsaw.
Yeah, we know who's going to win.
And it's also weird, like, watching, like, Yasuko fight him with, like, he's got this electric chainsaw and she's like, grill fork, like, over and over again. And then her son is also taking his little roller skate, like, boo, boo. And we're like, yeah, yeah.
Like, I get that you're trying, but this is not gonna help.
Yeah. It's just, like, ineffective and frustrating because we're like, you know, you guys are in the more dangerous position at this point. You know, you are trapped in this bathroom and this dude has this electric chainsaw that apparently is not giving up, you know, even though he's like cut through this door a kajillion times. But we have this like crescendo of danger where we know that eventually he's going to get through this door and like what's going to happen? You know, he's going to unlock this door. He's going to get at them. What's going to happen? And it doesn't end up going how you think it will. I mean, we have spoilers in this movie. There's a moment near the end, after you think everything's finished and done, he's left. There's a part where you think that he's gone. They smash the shit out of his hand. It's all gross. You hear the door open and shut. He takes his jacket. You think he's gone. And Yasuko's like, cool. Everything's good. I did it.
Put my kid to bed.
We're going to sleep. I'm going to take his little sockies off and everything's good. And then she opens the bathroom and it's like, oh, shit.
He's still here.
He's still here. And so then you have the like final showdown. And that's when we have that cool chase. She like tucks her son underneath the bed to protect him from harm, which is also weird because Yamakawa does not seem to be concerned about her son. Like, he doesn't want to hurt him.
Right.
He doesn't use him as like a leverage point or a hostage. In fact, when he gets home and starts hammering on the door, she uses him as a bargaining chip and he's like, no, I'll pretend to be a visitor while you take care of your son. Very weird. But he doesn't give a shit about him.
Right.
So she's able to like shove him underneath his bed and, you know, out of quote unquote danger. But then when we get to the point where we're actually going to have like the crescendo of this movie, Yasuko stabs him with this grill fork, which, by the way, the part where she stabs him in the face with it and he like pulls it through his skin is so good.
Oh, the effect is so good there.
It's so good. But she stabs him and like he, you know, is dying. She stabbed him in the stomach area. But then he like grabs her throat and it looks like she's like suffocating.
Yeah.
You know, like she's not going to be able to get out of this guy's reach. And she's reaching for the electric chainsaw and she can't quite make it work. I don't know why. Seems like she'd be able to, but like she's failing, you know, like
I think she just couldn't get the angle. Like she could reach it and turn it on. But with the way his arms were kind of wrapped around her neck, like she couldn't get the leverage to like get it around to any place it would actually hit him or hurt him.
Yeah. And maybe she also like was lacking the oxygen to be able to like,
yeah,
you know, do the thing. Like very tense scene there, you know, because Yamakawa's dying, but he's like, I'm not dying without taking you with me. And then the son comes in and like cracks him on the head with his tiny little baseball bat. And we're like, oh, okay, it's done. And then Yasuko half cuts off his friggin' head.
Yeah.
With this electric chainsaw. It's like, and the kid is staring and she is staring. She's got blood covering her. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's such a great scene.
So good. And it's kind of the end of the movie.
Yeah.
We see that his body has been placed in the shower and is being sort of hosed off, but we don't find out what happens from there.
Yeah. Like, does she, you know, is she like on trial for murder? Does she just get rid of the body? And she's like, nope, didn't happen. Even though her apartment is destroyed.
Yeah.
Completely destroyed. It's really good. I like that we're just kind of left open-ended, that we never see her husband come back home. We hear him on the phone right. A couple of times, but we don't know what's going to happen when he gets back home. We just know that Yasuko and her son are safe, and that's about it.
And there is a sequel, which Terrorvision has also remastered and released on Blu-ray and DVD, but I have not seen it. So I can't tell you yet whether any of these characters come back or whether the second film is simply a similar premise of a person being stalked and harassed in their home. TBD.
I read a brief synopsis on IMDb that says it is about a call girl.
Oh.
The second one is about a call girl. So
okay.
Not sure how that will loop into this kind of universe for this movie. I forgot to talk about this, but I did want to mention that Yamakawa is a very interesting bad guy.
Oh, yeah.
Because yeah. There's a scene where Yasuko answers the phone and it's this dude who's sexually harassing her on the phone and like saying foul things. And Yamakawa takes the phone from her. She doesn't say anything, but he takes the phone from her and listens to what this guy's saying. And he's like, you're disgusting. And the guy's like, who are you? And he's like, says something else and hangs up the phone. And it's such a weird line that immediately before this, Yamakawa is trying to rape Yasuko.
Right. Yeah.
He takes her to the bedroom, like rains condoms on her, and by knife point is trying to sexually assault her, or is sexually assaulting her. And then he answers his phone call. He's like, this is disgusting. And then afterwards, he's like, okay, now let's go back to the bedroom.
Right.
Like, what is that? What weird dichotomy? It's like an incel point of view.
Oh,
like
it totally mindset. Is. Yeah, absolutely. Because throughout the movie, he starts to say things as his behavior escalates about how he's in love with her. He starts off after their first incident saying how she's mean and she's cruel and this, that, and the other. But then he decides that he loves her. And so the only thing I could think is that he's like, again, like with a sort of incel mindset, trying to justify this assault by like, well, but it's not really assault because I love her.
Yeah.
Is the thing. Even though like,
I've been watching her. I'm paying attention to her. I love her. She's the object of my affection. So this is owed to me.
Right. Exactly.
Like this contact is the inevitable conclusion of what I've been doing. And
right.
then I will live here with her and we'll play, you know, play house basically.
Right. And like, look, I'm going after her. I'm complimenting her on her body in the pool. I'm singing songs to her on the payphone. You know, again, like if you take a sort of incel perspective on this, it's like all of the things, it's like the nice guy thing. Like, oh, but I'm being a nice guy. Like you are scaring people.
Right.
You know, like that's not what nice guys do.
Yeah. It's fascinating his mindset there because he has been nothing but violent and awful to her. He won't stop pestering her. He's made her feel in danger in her own home, in her own environment. And then he's like, no, this guy is bad. This guy is disgusting. Which, I mean, like, yes, it is disgusting and harmful.
Of course, yeah.
I used to work at a call center and there was a girl that I worked with there who had that happen to her. And like, she said every time she answered the phone, we would take like between 120 and 150 calls a day. She said every time she picked up the phone, there was like a little tiny part of her that thought, it's going to be that guy again. And like, it's going to be this dude. And she had that happen to her on the phone, but she also had that happen to her walking home from the bus one day.
Oh my gosh.
So it was like that, you know, that thing, like, so I'm just saying that, like, not to minimize that as being
right, absolutely
not bad. Yeah, yeah. But also, we're talking about a guy who is in this woman's apartment, has entered her apartment without her permission, has been stalking her, harassing her, observing her, you know, making claims against her, like all this stuff. And he is like, no, I draw the line at that.
Right. Right.
Like, what the hell is going on in this guy's head that makes him think like, no, this is fine. What I'm doing is fine and normal. But what this guy is doing is disgusting.
Well, and what makes him an effective and sinister villain is that we never find out what his deal is. You know, we never get, you know, like in many other scenes where you have, you know, this sort of stalker villain, you know, especially a man stalker killer rapist villain who is targeting women, you know, in a kind of psychosexual way. Sometimes in these movies we get the flashback of the effed up relationship with his mother or the cruelty of his father or whatever that may be. And while sometimes that can be effective, what I often think is more effective is that you don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know why he is this way at all or what triggered his fascination with this particular woman. Has he done this before to other? We have no clue. We only know what he is doing to Yasuko in this particular moment.
And they do give a tiny bit of context to that, which I wrote down this note and then I was like, I don't know, as to whether or not he's actually a salesman. Because remember, yeah, there's that part where he's like selling to that woman about how he's like, you can buy this course and there's, you know, you'll learn English as a second language and it's much different. And then when he goes to Yasuko's house, he's selling insurance.
Right.
So it's like totally different. So I'm like, is he actually? So I didn't know, because I'm like, I don't know what it's like there. Maybe they do have to sell multiple things. It's not like you're just selling one thing at a time. But it made me think, is he even really a salesman? That's or a is really he good just question. Like, is he requesting entrance into multiple people's houses and waiting for the time when he gets refused? And that's what like makes him, you know, makes him rise to mania.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't know. Like, there's lots of people who work in call centers where they have to sell like 1,000 different things.
Sure. Yeah.
So I was like, I'm not trying to make assumptions. I don't know how it works in Japan, but it could be that this guy is like totally unhinged and he's not actually selling anything.
That's entirely possible.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I definitely feel like I'm going to give the second at least, and maybe the third, a chance of this series, because I did really like this one. I feel like it definitely needs some more love.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for next time, we're going to go back to the 60s. We've been spending a lot of time in the 80s and in the modern era, but we're going to go back to 1968 and spend some time with Vincent Price.
Love it.
We don't spend enough time with on this podcast.
No, we don't.
And we're going to talk about Witchfinder General.
Which I don't know anything about this movie outside of the fact that Vincent Price is in it. And I know that it's set in the past. And there's witches.
It's Puritans. It's witches. It's, you know, the patriarchy. it's all the things. We'll have a lot to talk about for sure.
Well, I'm glad, because any time that I get to spend with Vincent Price is a good time. So
yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Attack of the Final Girls. Find us online at attackofthefinalgirls.com.
And hear bonus episodes at patreon.com/attackofthefinalgirls. We're Attack of the Final Girls on Instagram and TikTok.
Our theme music is by House Ghost and is available on Rad Girlfriend Records.
Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode, and rate and review on Apple Podcasts so more people can find the show. I'm Juliet.
And I'm Teresa. Until next time, stay scary.